You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Courtney and Alex.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you guys?
I'm tired as well.
Yes. A little tired.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 1,000 degrees outside.
It really doesn't help. I think that's actually what it is. No, it literally is 93 where I am, and you're also on the East Coast.
Yeah, I don't know what... I went outside for like 2 seconds, and now I have to sleep. But I'll record first.
Let me introduce us.
Oh, right.
So you are Courtney Rawlings.
I am.
And your friend here is Alex Jordan, although it's spelled like Jordan.
True.
And before I ask why it's pronounced that way... I want to say you guys are affiliated with the Quincy Institute and the co-hosts of this pretty darn new podcast called Always at War. Now, coincidentally, as you may have heard, the United States is at war right now.
Yeah.
I think when we scheduled this, was there a war going on? Mixed up. Involving the U.S. directly? No, it was just weapons. It was just weapons we supply. But anyway, we are now. In fact, right before we taped, we heard that Iran had... launched an apparently choreographed retaliatory strike designed not to kill anybody.
Right.
Apparently didn't kill anybody. So probably that will be that, for the time being. I don't mean things won't get ugly, but I suspect that Trump won't retaliate for that. Who knows? He didn't last time in the first term when he killed Iran's military commander by assassination, and there was a similar kind of quasi-choreographed strike. What we had decided even before we realized that we were going to be actually at war, when we taped this, we had said that we would each nominate a cause of war. What, like, our nomination for the most important or most persistent or something cause of war... and since, again, your podcast is called Always at War, now that Iran has happened, I think we will try to not only talk about some of the enduring causes of war, but how they may apply in this case. So first, you guys want to say a little about the Quincy Institute for, people who, I think most people listening have a sense for where it is on the spectrum?
Sure. So it's a relatively new for DC time standards, a couple of years old, like 6 years old now, a think tank. We're one of the very few orgs in DC that are actually pushing back against what has been a uniquely disastrous foreign policy consensus across parties for a great many years now. So seeking to restrain America's use of military force, advocate for using our considerable diplomatic muscle to prevent wars and, if not prevent them, bring a quick end to them. Courtney, what did I leave out?
Well, we're transpartisan. So as far as, that whole thing goes, I think we do a really good job at, steering past partisan lines and really just focusing on the issue of maybe unending war is bad for everyone.
Maybe doesn't make us safer. Maybe doesn't serve our interests particularly well. It's not like we have a big glaring example blinking over our shoulders today.
No, America never does it?
No.
And as you said, it's transpartisan. So you've got, people on the left and you've got people on the right. Now, there are two kinds of people on the right who sometimes do affiliate with the restrainer movement, as I guess it's called, because it's in favor of military restraint. You have the kind of Pat Buchanan type conservatives, I would say, represented by the American Conservative magazine. And then you got your libertarians.
Sure.
I don't know if you have some of both of those. I know that Kelly Vlahos, who's there, was at the American Conservative for a while. But in any event, that's the basic idea, left, right. I'm wondering, I know early in the Trump administration, I saw some enthusiasm on the, or some optimism, I guess, on the part of some conservative restrainers
sure.
that Trump finally, you know, we had, he was talking the talk. He didn't like regime change. That was before yesterday when he right. said regime change is this PC thing
right.
or the prohibition on talking about regime change was PC and he was in favor of regime change. That was yeah. yesterday. We don't know what today is. But in any event, so he was going to stop the Russia-Ukraine war. He was going to, I think, you know, he had taken credit for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I think the idea was he was going to see that through and consolidate it. And then he was going to negotiate with Iran and defuse this whole tension with Israel. I am personally still sensing some tension between Israel and Iran. I don't know what vibe you guys have been picking up lately.
Just a little bit.
But I, my question is, have they finally given up hope? The people who are right. hopeful?
Right.
You can't speak for them. I know, and we're not talking about any one person. But what
sure.
is your sense
sure.
from those in the restrainer community who are optimistic about Trump?
Sure, Kel. I think, Courtney, I'm going to jump in on this one. I think,
love it.
The thing about the presidency and is that it has accumulated an extraordinary amount of power intentionally. The national security state has intentionally consolidated all of this power to wage war and unilaterally shape foreign policy in the executive branch. So I think that there is always a fair strategic bet if a president or a presidential candidate shows some openness to restraining U.S. foreign policy, that if they get in office and follow through on that, they will have the political power to actually push through some changes. So I think there was plenty of reason, like you said, rhetorically, that Trump, you know, said a lot of things that were interesting about U.S. foreign policy. I mean, I don't know if you remember that first week in office, he talked about like cutting the Pentagon budget in half. He talked about total nuclear non-proliferation deals with Russia and China. Obviously, that was big talk without follow through. But, you know, the president has the ability to unilaterally reshape how America approaches the world. So I think people, it was a fair strategic bet to hold out hope that maybe he was going to do that. Now, I think the Iran case has made pretty clear that, you know, whatever his instincts are here, he is still being driven both within the U.S. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, Trump may not want to respond to Iran's retaliation. I think a factor that's different now than compared to 2020 is Bibi and Israel's involvement. You know, like Israel can have a veto effectively over any diplomacy by continuing their war in Iran. It doesn't mean they necessarily will want to. I think there is maybe an off-ramp right yeah. now as we speak. But I think the answer to that question is I think a lot of folks are disappointed to have seen this course of action. They're hopeful that maybe he'll take this off-ramp and de-escalation ahead. I don't think people have any regrets about betting on a change or hoping for a change is maybe a better way to put it. But I think this last week has made it pretty clear that when it comes down to it, Trump, like Biden before him, like Obama and Bush and you name it, favors military intervention as a way to solve problems. Even if he likes doing some of the diplomatic dance, ultimately, he has resorted to a military intervention that could have incredible costs and consequences.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure Israel will continue the fight for the time being. They say they're, Bibi says he's got it about wrapped up. We'll see. And Courtney, have you turned in your MAGA hat? Is this?
Yeah, I turned it in. No, I was pretty hopeful myself, like looking mm-hmm. at Trump's, you know, incoming presidency. And I think like the recent polls on just Iran kind of show that the expectations for Trump to be an anti-war or at least a kind of, you know, more critical of war president were foundational to his entire kind of spiel. Like I think just yesterday or 2 days, I don't remember, you know, the majority of Republican voters were against the war with Iran. Those numbers have now flipped as people kind of fall in line. But I do think that kind of exposes or at least showcases, yeah, there was this kind of sense or tendency that we were going to actually do America first. As for the Quincy Institute, I think we're pretty used to being fluid with politicians. You know, we take them at mm-hmm. their word, and then we expect the, you know, what you expect from a politician. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, that cohort is understandably just riding the wave.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the three nominees for biggest or most enduring or something cause of war. Although first, why do you pronounce it Jordan? Is that just because your family history is in the South, your roots are in the South, and so you call the country of Jordan, Jordan, in the South?
we still respect Jordan's sovereignty in the South, the country of Jordan. But yeah, Jordan is like an old Southern pronunciation, as my dad used to say. They did call it like the River Jordan in his church when they were... Mm-hmm. when he was studying Bible. So I do think
River Jordan is chilly and deep, as the church hymn lyric goes. Exactly. Yeah, and your father was in the Carter administration, right? Hamilton?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. He was in the Carter administration. You know, he passed away before I really gained much political consciousness. So I really wish I could talk to him about this moment. Wish I could talk to him about he volunteered in Vietnam, not in the army, but for IVS, the volunteer services. Ended up getting exposure to Agent Orange and, you know, ended up before he died of cancer. He had 6 or 7 different kinds of cancer, died of mesothelioma. And that was one among my like radicalizing moments that like America was sending volunteers into these fields to like help the Vietnamese civilian population and then also dropping Agent Orange on those same fields. And so I recently found like a poem he wrote from Vietnam talking about like ugly Americanism and like how we try and reshape the world in our own image. It was a real like full circle moment for me. Like I was in communication with him. Yeah.
As I was telling you before we started, I still remember the cover of Rolling Stone back when it was only a physical magazine in the late 70s with him and Jody Powell. They were thought of as, I think, kind of the two people who had helped catapult Carter to office. They were his two big people. Now, did your father wind up being chief of staff or what?
Yes. He originally, Carter didn't want a chief of staff because it was post-Nixon and it was trying to show like a new model of governance. But ultimately, they weren't able to really run the White House with that position. So my dad, he was eventually appointed to that. But then he also, he ran Carter's campaign, I think probably... His like enduring legacy is maybe I don't want to say for the best, but he was the one who told Carter like win the early primaries, get momentum, and go from there.
Well, Carter had this. He was the first person to turn the Iowa caucuses into a big deal. That had been an ignored thing, and maybe it was your father who thought up the idea of, since nobody was paying attention to it, going there, winning, declaring victory, and saying, "Look, we got momentum. The rest is inevitable."
Exactly
worked.
Exactly. Yeah, though he wrote a campaign memo in 72 laying out that exact strategy.
Really? So, really?
Yep.
So we have you personally to blame for all the coverage of the Iowa caucuses.
Of course. And like partially for like the neoliberal turn too. So
no, I haven't been holding you personally responsible for it.
You can. Everybody can.
I encourage that. One more thing about your father. What was I listening to? I think it was some deep dive history podcast about it was about handling the Shah of Iran, I think. And of course, Carter was pressured to let him have medical treatment in the U.S. We got some blowback for that. Did that help lead to the Iranian Revolution? I mean, let me say first, cut to the chase. I learned during that podcast, I don't remember the details, but that your father was a restrainer. I mean, there was at the time that became evident that there was something about who he had hoped, what kinds of people he had hoped would be in the foreign policy apparatus of the Carter administration. Mm-hmm. He wound up, I think, not being entirely thrilled, but it became evident that he was our kind of guy, I think.
Yeah, he gave a like ill-fated quote, I think after they won and before they got into the White House, where he's like, if Vance and Brzezinski are running the show, I'm resigning. And then that's who Carter appointed. So
that's it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that moment certainly has a lot to do with now. And I would argue, you know, 53 and the overthrow of Mossadegh has a lot to do with defining that relationship as well. But the story of the U.S. and Iran goes back a long time, and it's this today was not inevitable. I'll say that.
probably not. Yeah, the U.S. helped overthrow a democratically elected president in 53. And then just one quick reminder before we launch, I mean, asking you for the right. So was the decision to let the Shah, so he had been deposed already? And no. Because that was like 79. Was he still, remind me. So when they let him into the United States, what kind of blowback did that get?
I'm the wrong person to give this exact detail, but yeah, they let him into the United States to get treatment for cancer. And that, yeah, maybe the hostage crisis was while he was still overseas.
Yeah, it came back to haunt us somehow.
Well, it always does, doesn't it?
We do a lot of haunting things. So Courtney, I think we had thought that maybe Alex would go first with his nominee for enduring cause of war, but since I just forced him to recite his entire family history, and you have already told me that your last name Rawlings has nothing to do with the sporting goods company Rawlings, which leads me to have no follow-up questions at all.
I know. Maybe, like, where's the questions about my father?
Yeah.
A great guy, Brian Rawlings. How you doing?
So why don't, maybe you should go ahead and tell us what, name something that you think is often responsible for war.
I would go so far as to say it's always responsible, at least partially, for having to go to war. So mine is like, what I would argue is like one of the biggest reasons that the U.S. is constantly in conflict is because of moneyed interests. And there's a lot of them. So it's hard to, you know, kind of walk through all the ways that we're, you know, U.S. is so entrenched financially in some of these wars. One of my favorite that we had a recent episode on was on, you know, Congress people directly investing in Pentagon contractors. So I think in 2024, it was between 24 million and 114 million or 113 million invested by these 50 plus Congress members into Pentagon contracts. And obviously they see returns on those contracts. You know, it's led to a pretty bloated Pentagon budget and a lot of, you know, happy Congress people who get a kind of benefit from the largesse of our insane, you know, now nearing a trillion, soon to exceed a $1 trillion Pentagon budget. So I'd say that that's pretty like, you know, at the top. I mean, there's so many examples of how moneyed interests kind of are used to kind of keep us fighting wars or at least keep investing in the war machine. I think today it came out, you know, this is kind of an aside, but maybe it was yesterday. There was like I think it was New York Post, of course, came out with, you know, a great expose on Nancy Pelosi's own kind of investment success. I think she made, they were saying she made between 40 and a few hundred million dollars from her investments this year. And a lot of those, not a lot, I don't want to make too strong of a point, but at least some of those, it could be argued, resulted from alleged insider knowledge, right? So if, say, the U.S. decided to like bomb Iran and you had, you know, some knowledge of that, it would be totally within reason that you would go and you know, invest in like Honeywell or Lockheed stock, you know, earlier that day. And all you have
now
to do
that
is,
I assume, is actually hypothetical. We're not.
No. Although it's happened, like, I'm not saying about Nancy Pelosi, you know, we'll see if she did that, like, as time goes on, because technically she would have to fill out some forms and kind of, you know, showcase what she invested in. There's actually an app called Autopilot that tracks, you know, people like Pelosi's, but also like, you know, you can follow up a whole bunch of other Congress people's investments. But Pelosi's performed 46% above other, you know, similar investment vehicles. Like, she's just like really good at it. But when it comes back to like the Pentagon, you know, I think Tommy Tuberville, he has a weapons portfolio of a few hundred thousand dollars. And he allegedly, again, used his classified briefings as a member of the Senate Armed Service Committee to sell off Microsoft stocks like just weeks before the Pentagon canceled the company's $10 billion contract. Something similar happened with Nancy Pelosi, okay? She just happened to also know that. With Tommy Tuberville, it's a little bit more obvious. He was sitting in the room. I don't know about Pelosi, but anyway, so there's these kinds of moneyed interests.
Do we know that Nancy Pelosi owns defense contractor stocks?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, she does.
Because I just want to freeze frame on something. You know, she did something very provocative with respect to Taiwan. You remember she visited Taiwan and everybody's like, Biden was like, no.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, that heightens that in some small, admittedly small measure, probably increases the chances of war. And in any event, if it even increases tensions, it's probably good for defense stocks in some sense in the long run. It's kind of outrageous. You know, I it's funny. I heard somebody very recently referring to Trump's obviously pervasive corruption, and they were mentioning the Carter administration because Carter had a peanut farm, and I think he even had to put that in a blind trust.
Yes,
yeah. That's how careful they were in those days. So I don't know exactly what happened.
It's no longer the case now. I think like if you fail to disclose your investments, you get like a $200 fine. That's like as far as we've gone
under the Stock Act, and like the it's basically
$200. Well, that'll stop Nancy Pelosi. That's two cartons of ice cream.
Jenny's is getting up there in prices these days. But you're exactly right.
It's premium ice cream.
Just on the Taiwan trip point. I mean, you see this. It's a really good point with Pelosi. Like she was, presumably holding some of these stocks at that time. But you know, take another. China hawk, Mike Gallagher used to be the head of the China Select Committee. He left Congress to go work for Palantir. And, you know, since he's done that, he's penned, a half a dozen op-eds for Wall Street Journal about increasing military spending and countering China and getting serious about the China threat. And, these are just the kind of relationships that are built between government contractors, Pentagon contractors, and people in office. And, they see a path not only to like getting campaign support, but for getting a job when they leave office too, a pretty cushy one.
Yeah, I was going to say there's like pretty good evidence, that the Quincy Institute at least has that it's a good deal to, make nice with the Pentagon contractors, because after you leave office or say you're not reelected or say those same Pentagon contractors don't invest in your campaign and you risk losing, right? Well, don't worry, as long as you were like, again, this is alleged, but as long as you were, kind to them in some ways, there's often a door left open for you. And Mike Gallagher is like a great example. I mean, that's the revolving door of it all, but I think that is part of the moneyed interest.
It's bad. I at some point discovered there was this guy, I'm pretty sure his name is Bruce Jackson. He was, I think with Lockheed, this is back like 30 years ago or something, one of these big defense contractors, and he played a non-trivial role both in pushing, Project for a New American Century, this neocon outfit that influentially pushed for war with Iraq, and the NATO expansion thing. There was like a committee to expand NATO or something. So he was like a dual use. War technology himself. I've read that he's mellowed a little. He's not as maybe he's moved toward the dovish. I don't know. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's just par for the course. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there's a former congressman, I think from Arizona, Keel. I think it's John Keel, who like now is like overseeing the external body that's reviewing Congress's appropriations to build all these new nuclear weapons that we're going to spend just like billions and billions and billions of dollars. I think actually maybe trillions of dollars, Courtney, is that right? Yeah. The point being like he went from being in Congress to being a board member for a defense company and then turning around and also telling policymakers, we need to spend a shitload of money on building new nukes. And no, there's no worry about an arms race.
And they're like policymakers that you're like friendly with, right? Like it's great to get these, former legislators in the door because, look, they have all these connections. He's just like me for real. So they have like, you know, they're more likely to like talk to someone and listen to someone who was in their shoes and who they're probably seeing make, I don't even know how much cash. Like, I can't even imagine how much money you make from investing or working at these, you know, ginormous corporations who build our weapons, given that we provide weapons to 2/3 of all wars, you know, like we're also like,
is that right?
Yes, yeah, one or often more sides in 2/3 of the world's active wars. I think that stat was pulled in 2021 or 2022.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, Courtney, you mentioned Palantir. They represent this, you know, growing, you know, intersection between, you know, defense spending and Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley's always kind of had some of that, but the AI thing. And various other forces have, you know, I guess maybe the Pentagon just finally latched on to the importance of digital technology or something, but it just seems like there's increasingly pervasive influence in both directions. I mean, more people in Silicon Valley are China hawks. I mean, there's another reason for that. If they, like, you know, Sam Altman, you know, it's a way to keep the regulator's office back to say we got to stay ahead of China and AI. But it's really a thing of kind of growing magnitude. And if there's anybody out there who hasn't seen Palantir CEO Alex Karp on video, treat yourself.
Yeah.
Treat yourself. It's like if you were producing a low budget movie and you found some guy and said, play this totally crazy guy, like really crazy, like really, really, really crazy. And it was like a not great actor. This is what you'd get. I mean, check it out.
I mean, I sent this to Alex this morning. I mean, first of all, Alex Karp, I agree with you, Bobby. People have to go just Google him. They're also putting out these amazing commercials about why you should work for Palantir, where they're like, we're the cool guys. So what? Like, we're like kissing bombs. We think it's dope. You know, like, let's murder people, which is its own kind of sickening thing to watch. But I was sending Alex, I was like, we've got to invest in Palantir. There was like multiple articles out in the wake of Iran, of course, saying like, oh, if you invested, like, let's say like $5,000 by 2040, you could have $1 million. That's the kind of trajectory investors are seeing Palantir take. I mean, I think like VC money kind of ran dry in Silicon Valley. And you know what's even better and more reliable than the VCs is the freaking Pentagon, who doesn't even double check that you're doing what you say you're doing. There's almost no one overseeing or you know, like, are you overcharging us? You know, are we paying $56,000 for a trash can? Which, yes, has happened. It's way better than the VC people who want to see, like, you know, some return on investment. Plus that money ran out. So yeah, obviously they're going to come running to DC. I mean, it's just like a printing machine. You guys just print money over there. So
really quick,
I'm not talking to anyone in DC. So
on the Palantir front, I think it was Friday that one of the co-founders, because it was co-founded by Peter Thiel. It was also Joe Lonsdale, I think is his name. But he gave a TV network cable news interview where he was talking about he was supporting
Lonsdale,
yeah. Where he was like, oh yeah, regime change in Iran would be great. I'm actually very excited about the investment opportunities if the U.S. in Iran, if the U.S. can get all of the quote crazy people out of the government. So in some respects, they make it rather explicit.
Palantir being opposed to crazy people, I mean, come on. And just quickly, there's a particular video of Alex Karp. Maybe fear will get it. But yeah, have you guys seen the one where he says, we want them to fear? He goes on and on about how, like, our mission is to make everyone fear us.
Yes.
It's intense.
I think, that should be the guy who's, you know, designing our weapons. someone who's, like, blood hungry, very obviously, and says it all the time. Actually, on the Iran front, I think, I haven't checked, double checked this, but last I saw, it was like up like 85%, their stocks.
Palantir
in the wake of Iraq. But then, you know, of Iran, things did start to fizzle out in the last few days, I think. But anyways, like fighting wars, if Congress people are invested, okay, in these defense stock portfolios, and then the defense stocks rise the second there is a threat of war, let alone a real war. Yeah, that. you know, kind of is
Palantir
some sort
does
of
all this AI stuff. They're also involved in immigration, Trump's immigration stuff.
Certainly.
But like they're very good at keeping track of people. I think they may also do targeting software anyway.
Yes,
yeah, they do. They're using it in Gaza, I'm pretty sure. Right?
Yeah, and they just got up. I think they're up to 1.3 billion by 2029 that they expect to get for the Maven smart targeting system. It's all like
right, which is why I'm going to be a millionaire in 2040.
Right. Yes, Courtney's abandoning her principles, but she will get rich, which is the excusable outcome.
Yeah. Anything else to say about, I mean, you've got the whole revolving door thing at the Pentagon.
I mean, I could probably go on about this for like hours. So
yeah,
it's hard to say. I mean, like, I just do think like the fact that, you know, we are the arms dealer of the world, combined with the fact that our legislators either make money right now or later off those same sales. That can't be good, right? Like that. And I'll just say it's not, right? Like it's not good. And it certainly keeps us at war. So these people who, you know, are directly benefiting, you know, if whether or not we're threatening Iran or actually dropping bombs on them, there is an immediate return on investment from those postures. So there are people trying to make it illegal, but we'll see. I think there's just too much financial incentive.
Yeah. Peace through strength.
Yeah.
That'll so where's the peace? That's what
I'd love some of that.
When are they going to do the peace part?
I keep being told we are the strongest, and yet.
Mm-hmm. So what? One more Alex Karp thing. People should check out the piece by Connor Eccles in the Non-Zero newsletter. It was months ago, but it's timeless. So Mr. Jordan, what is your nominee?
Yes, I'm going to let you know. I'm so curious what yours is, Bob. I was wondering if we're going to have duplication, but I chose,
I think regular listeners can, well, there's one of like three hobby horses, I guess they can choose.
AI. Okay. So
I chose, Courtney and I, we discussed briefly before, and I think that the material interests are a very important part of the story. And, I wouldn't be a good member of the left if I wasn't looking at material causes or material and structural forces. Mm-hmm. But I would like to talk about something a little more conceptual. That is American exceptionalism. I think that American exceptionalism and some of the foreign policy thinking that stems from it is like totally baked into how politicians in Washington in both parties talk about our foreign policy and our obligations when it comes to military strategy. I mean, it's bipartisan. Like, it's the reason why Bush and Biden can sound so similar. Like, after 9/11, Bush reminded everybody that we are the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. And, you know, Biden, after his October 7th speech, or I think it was like October 19th, he gave it, and it was asking for more military aid for Israel and the Ukraine war. You know, he said, America is a beacon to the world. As my friend Madeleine Albright said, we are the indispensable nation. You know, we see taller. We have this responsibility being so strong and so smart to run world affairs. And so, you know, I think that a lot of Americans, I'll speak for myself, I'd be curious to hear from you guys. Like, I remember being taught about American exceptionalism. Like, I remember reading City on the Hill and learning about Manifest Destiny, like in my history classes growing up. And, you know, I learned this was invoked for greatness, these ideas of America as this very special country that had these special obligations, you know, in the founding of the country, in entering World War II and playing a decisive role in the defeat of Hitler. Even Lincoln in his 62 inauguration speech, he said, what was it? It was like, you know, America is the last best hope for Earth, and, you know, we must preserve it. And so we were taught that that has this great opportunities, but then it was also misused to justify colonialism and, you know, the Western expansion. And I think for me, I just learned that belief like ended after World War II, I guess. Like I just never applied it forward into our current foreign policy. But I think it's very prevalent. Like ultimately saying that America is the indispensable nation, that we're exceptional, that we have the special power and obligation, potentially from God, potentially secular obligation, because we're meritocratically amazing. this is a way to say what America wants, what America says goes. If we are exceptional and we are so special, what we do in the world is de facto justifiable because we have to do it. And this is what our whole foreign policy is built around, is creating this globe-spanning empire of bases and ability to intervene anywhere at any time because we have to. We are the king on the hill. And if anybody else did it, the world would fall into disrepair. And so to me, this is a load-bearing myth in foreign policy that really explains a lot about how we work in the world.
Ooh, that's a good one, Alex. I think that's so relevant for what's going on today. I mean, if you, I don't normally watch cable news, but I'm at my in-laws' house, so it's constantly on. And all I'm hearing
what
is
channel?
Like,
just out of curiosity, which cable news?
I will say one of them, and I'll tell you the other one off air. Newsmax is typically on, you know, constantly.
that's the moderate one.
That's the moderate. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's the moderate one.
I think we may be headed to OAN, folks, but I will find out off the air.
That's been constantly touting, American exceptionalism, but also America's moral exceptionalism, right? So we have a moral requirement to do things like regime change in Iran, right? Because they're not just like us, right? They're not modeled under, you know, liberal capitalists, whatever. And until they are, you know, the world is not free. And so I do think like that, I mean, that it's not news to any of us. We were here in the global war on terror. I heard that constantly, but it's been a while since I heard that myth touted so openly. Kamala's speech at the DNC kind of, you know, was similar. We must have the most lethal.
The most lethal military in the,
Sometimes I think I was hallucinating, but I'm pretty sure she threatened Iran in that speech, but no one ever is like, yeah, they definitely did. Anywho's, so I do think that's a good one, Alex. It is pretty conceptual, but, and yet it's like so concrete because, I mean, if you turn on any news station right now, you're going to hear the same thing over and over again. And that's to justify a war that kind of seems unjustifiable in other terms.
I mean, not to go Thomas Friedman on y'all, but my wife and I were at a bar and I'm in the Southern.
And a taxi cab driver walked in.
Of course. Exactly. Yeah. He took off his little cap. No, it was just some guy sitting across the bar from my wife and I. We live in California. And he just struck up a conversation or whatever and unprompted brought up Iran. This was before the U.S. had intervened, but brought up Israel-Iran strikes. And he said, you know, that guy's crazy. If we don't do it, nobody will. You know, what else do we have this military for? And I do think that a lot of Americans have really internalized how we talk about America having this global responsibility, policemen of the world, et cetera. And I mean, it makes sense because no matter what generation you are in, like if you're like me, like the Iraq War was like a foundational political memory for me. Like, you know, I was just in like growing my political consciousness post 9/11. Like I remember all of this talk about what we had to do and what our obligation was to the world and to freedom and to, you know, democracy via, you know, toppling Saddam. Or if you grew up in the Vietnam era and you remember like what America's responsibility was to roll back communism, because who else was going to do it? And what would happen if Vietnam fell? What would it mean for the global order? So like we've constantly gotten different servings of this, but it's not just modern history either. I mean, like go to the colonial wars. Like, I mean, there is something very exceptional about how the approach to the Philippines or you name it, like we are obligated to help these ill thinking people to reorganize their society around the values we know that work best for humankind, work best for God, you name it. And I mean, you can go back. I think this logic is like applicable across many of America's like great historic crimes, like including like the slave trade and stuff. And I was like, before this episode, looking up some quotes, just like interested in seeing how some of our modern presidents mentioned America's exceptionalism. Trump in this inaugural, I had totally forgotten. He said, "America will soon be far more exceptional than ever before," which is like a perfect Trump construction.
I think we're working on it. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a great Obama quote, which was, "I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being. But what makes us exceptional is not our ability to flout international norms and the rule of law. It is our willingness to affirm them through our actions." Applause break. "And that's why I will continue to push to close Guantanamo Bay." So, you know, Obama
How
was
that
like,
work out?
You could have gone so many directions with that. Oh my
yeah,
gosh.
But so
that's
he
why
was
I'm
going
to continue to bomb Yemen. You know,
what was making us special is that we were overcoming primacy.
Yeah.
We were overcoming these logics and we were imposing rule of law to how we approach the world. And mm-hmm. then he cited something that he failed to accomplish. Gitmo is still open and it's like part yeah. of the Trump administration's current deportation apparatus. And so like exceptionalism and like the way we think about ourselves and our responsibility to make the world right, like can really be invoked in all these different directions by politicians. But ultimately, it is like an or justification that is so popular in Washington and so popular with like all of our modern presidents that I think it's important to deconstruct the myth. That's definitely one of our goals with this show.
Yeah. Well, it was a laudable sentiment on his part.
Certainly.
He probably thought at the time that he would close Guantanamo. And, you know, he had his virtues. I got to say, he did get the Iran deal, nuclear deal done. And that took some heavy lifting.
Most definitely.
Because there were, you know, the pro-Israel crowd, for reasons that have been illustrated again, was not enthusiastic. And in fact, I mean, you know, Trump could have had basically a return to that deal, but he wasn't willing to let Iran enrich even to 3% under very strict monitoring. But yeah, Obama, I got to say, I mean, compared to Biden, compared to George W. Bush, compared to Trump, I mean, there were, you know, he had his foreign policy fiascos.
Sure.
But who among us isn't responsible for, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths in Syria and Libya or whatever? No, he's not totally.
Now, we're talking about a Nobel Prize winner. I don't want to hear you talking down to my president.
No,
I hear you.
Did Carter win the Nobel Prize?
I think, yes, I think he did in like
06,
I want to say.
And the Egypt-Israel thing. By the way, you said you read City on the Hill. Do you mean there was like an original sermon by Winthrop or something, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about the actual sermon?
I remember it in like, you know, my seventh grade history book. I was not reading the
Wow,
show off
was studying in seventh grade.
Yeah.
I was being
yeah.
cool and not studying.
I was just trying to unpack the world, man. Just yeah. trying to understand this crazy ride we call life. Yeah.
this is kind of related to my candidate, but we're not there yet. But we should, I'll tell you where we are. We are on the verge of overtime. As regular listeners and viewers know,
this is such an exciting moment for me.
You've heard it so many times and now you are part of it.
Paywall, Mom.
I'm with Bob in overtime. Many people don't know what happens there, you know, because they're not paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. It would be that easy to know what's going on in overtime, but they don't. So they think just regular stuff happens there.
We're going to get crazy.
You two are about to find out. It's a lot wilder than that. Plus, listen, no offense to either of you, but we always save the deepest insights for overtime. And I will be unveiling my candidate for, and we may dwell a little bit on American exceptionalism first, just to let the drama build after we get it overtime. But anyway. If you wanna be part of the fun, you can become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, set up your own little podcast feed that will always have the overtimes. But anyway, thanks to people who, even if you're not gonna do that, we thank them.
I guess we thank them less than the ones who do
we
it.
We double to triple thank the ones who.
Oh, I see. That's nice. That's nicer.
Who do come in over time?
Yeah.
We give mere thanks to the freeloaders, because we don't call them freeloaders because they're actually not getting into overtime anyway. So okay, look, I've said enough. My much noted marketing skills have been displayed enough, I think. So okay, thanks everybody.